KQED.
Funds for the California Report are provided by the California Healthcare Foundation, supporting ideas and innovations to improve healthcare for all Californians, on the web at chcf.org, and URS, a global engineering and construction firm working to improve California's public infrastructure, preserve the state's natural resources, and strengthen the environment. URS.com.
This is the California Report. I'm Scott Schaefer. On today's year-end show, profiles of extraordinary people, including an architect who lost his sight mid-career, plus a woodworker who imagines musical instruments, then makes them.
Instead of a saxophone, I was playing into it, but it was a goat hoof, you know, and like it had a double reed, and the next week he was actually building it.
It's the California Report. The final days of 2012 are ticking down, and for many, the new year is a time to take stock, to look back on the past 12 months and maybe resolve to do things differently in the year ahead. In that spirit, for this our final show of the year, we decided to introduce you to a few remarkable people here in California who, for one reason or another, are kind of inspiring.
My name is Chris Downey, and I'm an architect.
For the first 20 years of his career, San Francisco architect Chris Downey had an impressive but mostly typical portfolio of work. University libraries, wineries, aquariums, theaters, homes, that kind of thing. But his life was turned upside down at age 45. It began with changes in his vision. He noticed it while playing baseball with his son Renzo.
Everything else around was perfectly clear. It was just the ball that was moving and I couldn't. You know, it was just a fuzz.
Downey ignored it at first until he couldn't any longer. He went to an optometrist who said his eyes were fine. Then he went to see a neurologist who ordered an MRI. The news wasn't good.
Sort of a golf ball-sized tumor right at the optic nerves, and it sort of squished them, pushed them out of position, and really stretched them out a good bit.
It wasn't cancerous, but the tumor had to go. There were two options. One was radiation, which would destroy the optic nerve. Instead, he chose surgery. A safer option, but not without risk. In the hours after the operation, his vision was fuzzy, as expected.
The second day, I woke up, and sight was partially gone. It was almost like a water line straight across both eyes, where it was dark above, and the same fuzzy vision below. So I was taken back to ICU, and the next time I woke up, it was all gone.
The news was devastating. But when Downey was 7 years old, his father died after surgery to remove a brain tumor. So he knew things could have been much worse. Still, when a social worker who visited Downey in the hospital suggested he think about another line of work, it did not go over well. Instead, he went back to the office less than a month later.
It's almost like getting back to work before everybody else could draw their own conclusions of, oh, you can't see, you can't be an architect.
Now, there's never a good time to lose your sight, especially for architects. But it was 2008, and many people, including Downey, lost their jobs as the economy sank into recession.
You have a profession where, you know, seeing is not an option, really.
Yeah, and the business side, you can do that. The economics, you can do that. It's the creative side, it's the drawing that was the real challenge.
Now, as you might have guessed, Downey isn't easily deterred. He set out to learn a new way to draw and read drawings, the creative part of architecture. The key turned out to be a printer that could generate embossed drawings.
So instead of printing ink on paper, it basically pushed a raised line, series of dots, to create a tactile image.
And Downey had a visual library, an imagination full of drawings and buildings. He just needed a way to put his visual disability to work. His first project, working as a consultant with architects designing the new Polytrauma Blind Rehabilitation Center at the VA campus in Palo Alto.
And that was sort of a huge leap for those firms to hire me as a blind architect. Mm. Yeah, it's like, are you kidding?
The building will serve vets who are blind and visually impaired. Using his own experience as a now blind architect, he helped the design team understand what it's like to navigate a three-story facility without being able to see.
It's really easy with sight to go straight down the middle of the space and to end up at the other side or to end up at the bottom of the stair.
Without thinking about it.
Yeah, piece of cake. Not so easy if you can't see it. So the simple thing of go straight is challenged if you can't see where straight is.
Among the architects Downey has worked with is Dennis Sullivan, director of design for a firm in San Francisco. Sullivan calls Downey one of the best communicators he's ever met in architecture, a skill he thinks is even sharper now that his focus is unfettered by visual clutter. He adds that while Downey can't see, he takes full advantage of his other senses, something most architects don't do.
They don't design with smelling. They don't listen to the way the building feels. They don't design with this concept of emotion, touching, feeling, listening, walking. What is that emotional experience? And so he rekindles it. He brings that back to life.
Chris Downey rents space from an architecture firm in downtown San Francisco. He's still reimagining his life and career as a consultant. Working with design teams, he's helped develop housing for the blind in New York City and a new clinic for an eye center at Duke University and another in San Francisco.
To be successful as a blind person, it's not you can't walk around thinking, holy crap, I can't see. Yeah, that doesn't get you very far.
Downey says he and his son have figured out a way to still enjoy baseball together, and he's taken up a new sport that doesn't require vision, rowing. He and his wife Rosa, who's also a designer, recently traveled to Italy, where he sang with a church choir in Rome, Florence, and Assisi. Downey has rediscovered music since losing his sight, another way he's making the most of a situation many would see as less than ideal.
It's like I'm more excited about architecture now than I was sighted, and I'm more excited and thrilled with life. I might be weird in that regard, but it's just been an incredible experience.
Since losing his sight, Chris Downey has connected with two other blind architects, one in Lisbon, Portugal, the other in Chicago. His New Year wish for 2013... growing his consulting business into something more financially sustainable by leveraging his disability into an asset. Most of us are multitasking these days, but Emily Yates takes it to a new level. The 30-year-old UC Berkeley student is also a musician and a writer and a photographer and an activist. All of these parts of her identity developed out of an intense experience she had after answering a fateful phone call when she was just 19 years old. Lisa Morehouse has this profile.
Emily Yates just got out of her final exam for an Arabic class.
I've got two more, Islam in South Asia and Middle Eastern politics. I'll be ready to party by Friday night.
She's a Near East Studies major at Berkeley.
I didn't really have any understanding of history in the Middle East and South Asia, and now I've got a lot more of it. To the extent that I'm kind of annoying at parties if people want to talk about the Middle East, and I'm like, well, the Ottoman Empire.
This passion stems from her time in the U.S. Army. During two deployments to Iraq, Yates started asking a lot of questions.
When I was deployed, I knew that it was wrong for us to be in Iraq. I did not know why.
She says studying the war she was a part of is surreal.
It was really weird this semester, looking through my syllabus and seeing a section on Operation Iraqi Freedom. And I was like, that's the war I was in. I wonder what I'm going to read about it. We are headed to my secret hideout.
We go to Yates' favorite place to relax on campus, a top-story empty room with a balcony and views of the whole San Francisco Bay Area. Yates says everything she studies gives context to her war experience.
And it just really makes me want to keep learning and has made me even more cynical than ever about government propaganda. I mean, I helped produce it, basically, for the military.
Yates was a member of the Army's public affairs team. First on a base in the United States, then at Camp Victory, Iraq, she wrote articles for internal publications.
They were all ridiculously optimistic about the mission in Iraq. and I knew that that was wrong.
So how did Yates end up in a war, she questioned. Raised in upstate New York, Yates says she hit a rough patch in her teenage years. She dropped out of high school, then boarding school, got a GED, and went to community college when an Army recruiter called.
And said, "Hey, what's your major?"
Yates told him she hoped to go into journalism.
He said, "Well, I can get you a journalist job in the Army."
This was December of 2001, just months after 9/11.
And I was like, "I want to be a journalist, so I want to cover the story. I'm definitely not going to be able to do that if I'm in community college in Syracuse. So why not?" But I got in, and there I was, a public affairs specialist.
She was sure she'd end up in Afghanistan.
Because that was where Osama bin Laden was, right?
Near the end of her training, a drill sergeant approached.
He said, "Soldier?" I said, "Yes, drill sergeant." And he said, "How do you feel about going to Kuwait?" And I said, "Roger, drill sergeant." And I walked away and started thinking, why would I go to Kuwait? Why would I go to Kuwait? Oh my God, we're going to invade Iraq.
During her first year-long deployment in Iraq, Yates didn't feel anything like a war reporter. Camp Victory was a frequent target for attack, and she lived with the possibility of dying every day. But she also felt stuck at division headquarters doing layout for an Army publication.
After a while, after demanding enough, I was finally able to go out and cover some stories. You know, I went out on patrol a couple times. I went out and covered a night raid one time. I covered the elections in December 2005. But this time I was well aware I was not going to be writing my own view about what I was seeing.
Increasingly, she felt she had little control and got more and more upset when she was called back to Iraq under the stop-loss policy.
I was a very, very, very angry person during that second deployment.
Now, more than 4 years later, her methods for healing include school, activism, and art. For a class last semester, Yates made a short documentary film exploring Islamophobia in the military. She interviewed veterans from different military branches and asked about how their training and experience shaped their perceptions of Muslims.
How did you picture the terrorist?
Honestly, just like everybody else, something wrapped around their head, beard, and screaming Allah, you know, Allah Akbar. Not proud of that, but that's what I thought. Right after 9/11, yes, I did.
And for more than 2 years, she's worked with the organization Iraq Veterans Against the War.
And I really enjoyed immediately the sense of relief I got from just being around other people who had the experience of being in a war that they were not supportive of.
She volunteers on their campaign to keep military personnel with PTSD from being redeployed. This is personal for Yates.
You know, I don't know that I necessarily had PTSD after the first deployment, but I definitely was not in good shape and shouldn't have been deployed again. And I know lots of other people in that same boat.
For six god awful years, I knew if you ain't cheating, you ain't trying. That's what the Army pounded into my mind.
Last year, she recorded an album of upbeat folk songs with satirical lyrics, many of which touch on her military experience. In mid-December, she sang and played ukulele and banjo at a small concert in the Berkeley studio where she recorded her album.
The military was a quite traumatic experience for me overall.
But she knows without it, her life now would be vastly different.
And I'm actually pretty happy with my life the way it is now, so I can't have any regrets.
She just doesn't want anyone else to endure the kind of pain she did. When Emily Yates graduates, she hopes to gather musical veterans of the Iraq War for a trip back to the Middle East to play with Iraqi musicians. For the California Report, I'm Lisa Morehouse in Berkeley.
You ain't trying. That's what the army pounded into my mind. Keep your head down low. Don't volunteer to go nowhere. Cheat the system and you'll beat it every time.
There's a thriving community of instrument makers in California. Rachel Dornhelm has this profile of one who's working to bridge forward-looking experimental music with the ancient craft of woodworking.
In an industrial office park in the Marin County city of San Rafael, forklifts move pallets in and out of giant garages. The last thing you might expect to hear are the plaintive cries of a string instrument coming from a workshop.
My name is Sung Kim. I'm an architectural woodworker and designer and a furniture maker. Currently, my focus has been musical instruments.
Instruments, not violins or cellos. The ones Kim points out in his cavernous workspace you've probably never heard of.
That's the ox. It's a three-string banjo. It's fretless. This would be the nun's horn. This, with the analog circuit, it is the holy water sprinkler.
You've never heard of these before because Kim invents them from the sounds he imagines he'd like to hear and from hybrids of instruments he's seen.
You get three different rhythms going at once if you're so inclined. African music was what inspired this one. You get this really nice hammering sound.
So if someone can imagine like a whack-a-mole game where these things keep popping up from
exactly.
Underneath.
And they're actually what hits a string. I mean, it's historically clavichord was a piano where, like a piano where basically it was just a hammer that hit from the below.
Kim was a punk rock loving teen in Washington, D.C. when he first started building his own guitars. But things changed when he was 21, and he heard a recording of Indian sitar player Ravi Shankar.
My head kind of split in half, and I was like, wait a second, I've been focusing on this Western instrument, and there's the rest of the world, all these sounds, all these instruments, all these different approaches that I've been ignoring.
Recently, Kim has been working with animal hides. Like on one instrument where he stretched a hide taut over a faceted frame so it looks like one of Picasso's cubist violins. Mostly, though, Kim creates with wood. Right now, he's working on the body of a new instrument, hollowing out a piece of Alaskan yellow cedar, his favorite for soundboards. Kim's instruments can take anywhere from days to years to complete. He learned his skills from a young age, working side by side with his father, a Korean-trained builder.
There wasn't much talking. It was always, okay, make this, do this. At the time, it was a little bit irritating. But it teaches you to develop your own style. It teaches you to develop, you know, just a brain that takes apart and dissects how to build something versus this is how it was supposed to be built.
Kim took a detour through a different medium, clay, in art school. Along the way, he met his wife, the granddaughter of a Bay Area shipbuilder. And now the two families' tools hang side by side. The Western-style tools from his wife's family.
The Asian-style ones are primarily from my father. So it's, you know, and the thing is, the techniques that are involved with these two styles, they're kind of contrary, you know. So it's nice to actually mix two together.
Kim doesn't make money from his instrument building, but he has incorporated some of the principles into his woodworking business, where his clients range from homeowners to museums. Kim shows me a media cabinet a client just commissioned.
This whole thing actually resonates, so the power amp would actually power this to become a giant speaker.
Just as his woodworking style is improvisational, so is his music. On a recent night, about 15 people gathered for an intimate concert featuring Kim and three musicians playing his instruments. High school art teacher and saxophonist Brian Peterson was in the audience. He's played with Kim for about 2 years and says very few people have Kim's combination of inspiration and craftsmanship.
You know, he called me one time saying that he had a dream about an instrument where
instead of a saxophone, I was playing into it, but it was a goat hoof, like the hoof of it, you know, and like it had a double reed. And the next week he was actually building it.
Peterson says even seasoned improvisers often have a safe place they can retreat to in their music. But he says it's impossible to do that on novel instruments like Kim's. Kim says his goal is to make a living selling them.
Or even to work with a musician and to design an instrument, say they would come back in a month and say it needs this. The upper register is too high, it needs more strings, it needs less strings. I would stop doing architectural work. No, are you kidding me? That's the absolute dream, definitely.
Kim says he's lucky he landed in California 10 years ago, where there are both clients for his high-end architectural woodwork and a vibrant experimental music scene.
California is a place where I always dreamt about. As a kid, even. You know, you listen to the Beach Boys. I could not exist. What this shop does, what I do for a living, wouldn't exist anywhere else in the world, I don't think.
It's only from this geographic home base, says Kim, that he can explore all the musical terrain he has in mind. For the California Report, I'm Rachel Dornhelm.
You can see and hear some of Sung Kim's musical creations at californiareport.org. Earlier, we heard about a blind architect who's learning to make the most of his loss. Now we go to the Central Valley, where some kids are adapting to adversity on the ice. They're learning how to play sled hockey. It's like ice hockey for people who've been injured or born with a disability. The U.S. has won 2 sled hockey gold medals in the Paralympics, most recently in 2010. Reporter Alice Daniel put on her skates to find out more.
We'll see how fast you can go. Want to race you?
Pediatric surgeon Adam Gora is in the rehab gym at Children's Hospital Central California near Fresno, egging on a very athletic Jordan Gifford who uses prostheses to run.
Probably the farthest place would be outside.
Let's race to the wall.
There you go.
Gifford has a rare genetic disorder that causes limb deformities, but otherwise he's just like any other 7-year-old. He's tried rock climbing and water skiing for free through the hospital's adaptive sports program. It's run solely by volunteers through donations and grants. Now he wants to try sled hockey, a program Gora is starting. Gora says play is a fundamental right of every kid.
If you can find ways to get these kids to play, because every child needs to play, no matter what their abilities are.
17-year-old David Moreno is also very athletic. He played soccer and football last year at Tulare Union High School. But in September, that changed.
Me and my dad got in a car accident, and I broke my back. And so I lost feeling from my waist down.
Moreno has already tried one adaptive sport, rock climbing. But he says sled hockey sounds even better.
You can be aggressive in it, just like football and soccer, and use your body.
Sled hockey is like ice hockey, except the players move around in sleds with blades, kind of like sitting in a giant ice skate. They propel themselves with the back ends of 2 shortened hockey sticks. Injured war veterans returning from the Middle East have taken up the sport to stay active, and it's gaining in popularity, especially as the U.S. is the defending world champion in the Paralympics. Still, there are only a handful of teams in California.
Next is to get with a partner. We're going to find a puck, and we're going to work on passing the puck back and forth.
Brian Rathfelder was paralyzed 5 years ago when his motorcycle turned over on him. He's come up from Bakersfield to the Holiday Ice Rink in downtown Fresno to teach sled hockey basics to Dr. Gora, other volunteers, and kids with disabilities.
We get into playing this, you guys are really going to see the fun in it, and I know you guys are going to be ready to come back for tomorrow and do it all over again.
He says there's no greater feeling than gliding on ice.
I can't compare it to anything else in the world. To glide across the ice is, you know, such a liberating feeling.
Sled hockey is very expensive. It's gear intensive and can require a lot of grassroots resources.
We can use this whole roll of tape. We just want to make sure Jordan has a good time out here.
Some volunteers rig up a bulky glove on 7-year-old Jordan's small right hand.
Try to tape this part.
You are a good man, you know that? You're a trooper.
Finally, everyone is in their sled with helmets and gloves secured. Rathfelder offers some advice.
If you guys haven't figured it out already, you'll notice that if you push with your right arm, you'll head to the left direction. You push with your left arm, you'll head to the right direction. And if you push with both, most of the time you'll go straight.
Dr. Gora, who plays ice hockey, asks if he can do a hockey stop in a sled.
You get going fast enough, get your sled sideways, and you can do a hockey stop.
Using his two shortened hockey sticks, Rathfelder pushes his way over to talk to Moreno, the high schooler who recently lost mobility in his legs.
I never thought I'd ever go ice skating outside, let alone in California.
Yeah, it's fun. I like it so far.
Good.
Before Moreno glides gracefully around the ice again, I ask him what he thinks.
Yeah, well, it's my first time actually being on, like, an ice rink. It's very fun. I mean, you can move pretty quick, slide all over the place.
His parents and two sisters stand outside the rink watching. His father, Ernie Moreno, was in the car accident that broke his son's back.
I want to keep him active on all the sports that we can. I want to keep his mind rolling so that he's not thinking other stuff, you know.
Physician Jennifer Crocker founded the all-volunteer adaptive sports program at Children's Hospital Central California 5 years ago. She says adaptive sports give kids new goals, especially after a sudden paralysis.
It's the biggest change in anyone's life that you can really imagine. And it's often devastating and tragic at first, and for the family as well. And then this provides a very different perspective.
Charlie Avery knows this well. He's also on the ice today teaching kids the sport. When he was 4, he got hit in a random drive-by shooting in East Bakersfield.
We had videos of me walking before, and I was like, man, I don't even remember those.
He's been in a wheelchair ever since, and at 22, says sled hockey makes life richer.
Great workout, just pushing around. It's a thrill just being on the ice.
Pediatrician Adam Gora knows what the ice means to kids who feel liberated as they glide around. His goal is to find sponsors and form a thriving sled hockey team within the next 2 years.
One down, one down.
For the California Report, I'm Alice Daniel in Fresno.
And that's the California Report, a production of KQED Public Radio in San Francisco. You can always find us online at californiareport.org or at facebook.com/thecaliforniareport. Our director is Susie Rocho. The technical producer is Seal Muller. We have additional engineering from Howard Gelman. Our online team includes Lisa Pickoff-White, David Marks, and Don Clyde. Our interns are Catherine Borgeson and Rachel Johnson. Polly Stryker was a contributing editor. Our associate senior producer is Victoria Maleone. The senior producer is Ingrid Becker. The news director is Bruce Kuhn. I'm Scott Schaefer. Thanks for listening. Have a good weekend and a really great new year. This is the California Report.
Funds for the California Report are provided by the James Irvine Foundation, expanding opportunity for the people of California and supporting the California Report since its premiere in 1995. And the California Endowment, health happens in neighborhoods at calendow.org. And Chevron, committed to helping California grow by supporting small businesses and investing in education. More information available at chevron.com.